Hello and welcome to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tale. It's wonderful to have you here. Can you believe this is the podcast's second birthday episode? I think that's the way you say it. Second birthday episode. This is the podcast birthday episode. Second one. Anyway, whichever way round, it's definitely a cause for celebration. I'm so glad if you're here from the start and you're still with me. I'm so pleased you're still here. If you're brand new and shiny, then you're very, very welcome all the same. As is normal, first there'll be the story. Then there'll be me talking about the story, the history of the story, and a little bit about the food in the story. Some of that's history, some of that is folklore. And then I would say there's normally a recipe, and there is normally a recipe. But today there isn't. There isn't because when you hear what the food ingredient is, you'll understand. It would be too hard to pick, and you wouldn't really want one that was made just of our ingredient. So, gentle listener, are you listening comfortably? Then I'll begin. Well, there was once a very rich gentleman, and he had three daughters, and he thought to see how fond they were of him. So he said to the first, "How much do you love me, my dear?" "Why," she said, "as I love my life." "That's good," he said. He was happy. And he said to the second, "How much do you love me, my dear?" "Why," she says, "better than all of the world." "That's good," he said. He was pleased. He said to the third, "How much do you love me, my dear?" "Why," she said, "I love you as fresh meat loves salt." He was so angry. "You don't love me at all," he said. "And in my house you will stay no more." She wept as she loved her father, but it was to no avail. And he wouldn't change his mind. So she dried her eyes, made a bundle of her jewels and her best dresses, and hurriedly left the home where she was born. She didn't know where she was to go, but she went away and on until she came to a fen, and there she gathered a lot of rushes and made them into a cloak, well, sort of, with a hood to cover her from head to foot and hide her fine clothes. And then she went on and on and on and on again. She was so tired. But eventually she came upon a great house. "Do you want a maid?" she said. "No, we don't," I said. "I haven't anywhere to go," she said, "and I wouldn't ask for any wages, and I'd do any sort of work." "Well," they said, "if you like, you can wash the pans and scrape the pots, and you can stay." So she stayed, and she washed the pots, and she scraped the saucepans, and she did all the dirty work. And because she never gave them her name, they called her Cap of Rushes. Well, one day there was to be a great dance a little way off, and the servants were to go and look at the grand people. Cap of Rushes said she was just, well, too tired to go. They didn't try and persuade her. She did look quite grubby, and she stayed at home. But when they were gone, she took off her cap of rushes. She washed herself. She put on her gown as pale grey as the dawn, which shimmered as she moved, with white opals clinging to the dress in patterns, reflecting both the setting moonlight and the rising dawn. And they went to the dance. And no one there was as finely dressed as her. Well, who should be there but her master's son? And what should he do but fall in love with her? The minute he set eyes on her, he wouldn't dance with anyone else. But before the dance was done, Cap of Rushes, well, she stepped off and away she went home. And when the other maid came back, she was pretending to be asleep with her Cap of Rushes on. Next morning they said to her, "You did miss a sight, Cap of Rushes." "What was that?" she said. "Why, the most beautiful lady you have ever seen, dressed in gleaming grey silk. The young master, he never took his eyes off her. Well, I should have liked to have seen her," said Cap of Rushes. "Well, there's to be another dance this evening. Perhaps she'll be there." But come the evening, Cap of Rushes said again she was too tired to go with him. However, when they were gone, she offed her cap of rushes, washed herself and dressed herself, but this time in a gown of dazzling green silk, with wheat stems embroidered all over in gold thread, and tiny wildflowers made of tiny coloured jewels scattered amongst them, and away she went to the dance. The master's son had, well, he'd been hoping to see her, and he danced with no one else, and he never took his eyes off her. And before the dance was over, she slipped off, and home she went, and when the maids came back, she pretended again to be asleep, with her cap of rushes on. Next day they said to her again, "Cap of rushes, you'd have been there to see the lady." There she was again, beautiful, but this time in dazzling green, and the young master, he was dazzled, and he never took his eyes off her. "Well, there," she said, "that's a shame. I should have liked to have seen that." "Well," they said, "there's a dance again this evening, and you must go with us, for she's sure to be there." Well, come the evening, Capybrush said again she was too tired to go, and no matter what they said, no matter how much they tried to persuade her, she stayed at home. But when they were gone, she offed her cap of rushes, washed herself, and dressed herself this time in a gown of deep midnight blue silk, with moons embroidered in silver thread, and stars sparkling with a frost of 1,000 diamonds, and away she went to the dance. The master's son was so glad when he saw her. He danced with none but her, and never took his eyes off her. When she wouldn't tell him her name, nor where she came from, he gave her a ring, and told her, if he didn't see her again, he would die. And before the dance was over, again she slipped and home she went, and when the maid came home she was pretending to be asleep, with her cap of rushes on. Well, next day they said to her, "There, cap of rushes, you didn't come last night, and now you won't see the lady, for there is to be no more dances." And she was in her heavenly dress last night, covered in diamonds. "Well, I should have really liked to see that," said cap of rushes. The master's son, he tried every way he knew to find out where that lady was gone and who she was, but go where he might and ask him he might, he never heard anything about her, and he got worse and he worse and more ill for love of her, till he had to keep to his bed. "Make some gruel for the young master," they said to the cook, "he's dying for love of the lady." The cook, well, she said about making it, and when Cap of Rushes came in, she asked, "What are you doing?" "I'm going to make some gruel for the young master," said the cook, "for he's dying for love of the lady." "Let me make it," says Cap of Rushes. Well, the cook wouldn't at first, but at last she said yes, and Cap of Rushes made the gruel. And when she'd made it, she slipped the ring into it on the sly before the cook took it upstairs. The young man, after being persuaded, basically by his own mother, who said that she would die if he didn't drink it, drank it, and saw the ring at the bottom. "Send for the cook," he said. So up she came. "Who made this gruel?" he said. "I did," said the cook, for she was frightened. He looked at her. "No, no, you didn't," he said. "Say who did it, and you won't be harmed." "Well, then, it was Cap of Rushes," she said. So Cap of Rushes came. "Did you make the gruel?" he said. "Yes, I did," she said. "Where did you get this ring?" says he. "From him as gave it to me," says she. "Who are you then?" says the young man. "I'll show you," she said, and she took off her cap of rushes, and there she was, clean and shining, in her sparkling midnight blue dress. Well, after that, the master's, well, he got well very soon, and they were to be married in a little while, and it was to be a very grand wedding, and everyone was asked, far and near, and Cap of Rushes' father was asked. But she still never told anybody who she was. But before the wedding, she went to the cook, and she said, "I want you to dress every dish without a mite of salt." "That is going to be very nasty," said the cook. "That don't dignify," said she. "Well, very well," said the cook. And the wedding day came, and they were married. And after they were married, all the company sat down to their meal, and they began to try the meat, and it was so tasteless they couldn't eat it. But Cap of Rushes' father, he tried first one dish and then another, and then he burst out crying. "What's the matter?" said the master's son. "Oh," he said, "I had a daughter, and I asked her how much she loved me, and she said as much as fresh meat loves salt, and I turned her from my door, for I thought she didn't love me, and now I see she loved me best of all, and she may be dead, for all I know." "No, father, here she is," said Cap of Rushes, and she went to him, and she put her arms around him, and everyone in that hall was happy ever after. And that, gentle listener, is the end of my tale, and I hope it pleased you, for it had no other purpose. So, what did you think of the story? I love this. The heroine picked herself up after being thrown out of her own home, simply because her father did not appreciate the subtleties and language of her love for him. She found her own way in the world, assisted by excellent fashion and very good cleaning skills, and then found love and a husband. I know it's not exactly a feminist ending, or perhaps not even exactly a feminist story, but you have to appreciate the context of the time. Marriage was really her only option. There wasn't exactly an alternative route for young women with ideas, sadly. Would it surprise you to know that this is a Cinderella story? No, really, it is. There is a book, I've mentioned it before, it's called Cinderella, 345 variants of Cinderella, catskin and cap of rushes, abstracted and tabulated with a discussion of medieval analogues and notes by Marion Ralph Cox. That's the title, isn't it? It's from 90-something, so that perhaps explains it. There are 20 Cap of Rushes tales in this book alone, from all over Europe. Marion Cox is the one who suggested that this type of tale has a King Lear judgment, as opposed to the catskin stories, which have a worrying amount of incest instead. Cap of Rushes was never at risk of harm from her father, except for possibly neglect and distress over her abandonment, due to a, quite frankly, ridiculously small transgression. He, at least, didn't want to marry her because she looked like her mother. He may be setting a low bar off, but no incest is always good, in my opinion. We don't have time here for my views about King Lear, so I'll summarise and say I'm not his biggest fan. You may recognise some of these themes from an early episode, where I explored an Italian variant of the story, which involved a giant candlestick and food theft and a lot less washing up. Our tale today is the British variant, well, one British variant anyway, which apparently is from Suffolk, as recorded by Joseph Jacobs in Folklore, the journal. The story appeared later in the same form in his English Folk Tales collection, and later in other collections by other editors. You'll note there is a lack of magic in this tale. Other variants often feature supernatural help from a godmother or equivalent, and dresses appear magically from nuts or plants. Our heroine, whose name we actually never learn, just takes the dresses when she leaves home. I think you'd need supernatural help to get the creases out of those silk, but perhaps the steam in the kitchen was of some assistance. This tale is actually a mixture of two tale types, ATU 510B, donkey skin, but without the incest as mentioned above, and ATU 923, love like salt, which is also where it differs from the Italian tale I discussed, which does not have the donkey skin element. I also love our tale doesn't require animals to be killed to create the disguise, mostly because I love both donkeys and cats and would prefer them to remain unharmed, also because of the ick factor. Rushes seem fairly practical as these disguises go. There is a variant where the heroine has a wooden dress as a disguise, which seems tricky to manage, but I suppose it would definitely protect your clothes. There's always the concern that rushes could catch fire fairly easily in a kitchen, but presumably that would be worse if you were actually cooking, rather than just washing the pots. I think it's truly amazing how much a wash and a gorgeous frock can distract your colleagues and a prince, or local equivalent, from noticing what your face looks like. You can forgive the young man in this case if he never actually sees her in the kitchen, but the rest of the servants do seem, well, I'm going to go with unobservant. I think it's because I've been listening to a lot of wonderful Norwegian tales, and the same effect seems to happen with Ashland, but at least he usually has an amazing horse, so he'd be a lot further from the ground, which I think would make recognition harder. Anyway, I digress. Obviously, the young man does eventually recognise his love when she has had another wash and popped her favourite frock back on, and he's received his ring back, which presumably most wealthy young men could manage, even if they had to have a couple of goes first. So, we move on to the grand wedding feast, which is another area where this variant is a little different. In this one, all the food is unseasoned, not just that of our heroine's father, which I personally don't think is as effective when the father's the only one served the unusual food and becomes more and more confused as others don't seem to be having the same experience as him. I also was concerned about all the possible wasted food and the damaged reputation of the cook. I suspect, well, in fact, I know I'm overthinking it. There is a Love Like Salt variant, where the princess runs away to an inn, and learns to be an amazing cook and is invited to cook at the royal palace at the wedding of her sister, because of her amazing reputation. It's a personal favourite, but it's a little too short to share as part of the podcast. I may add it to a selection of short tales and record them for you all one day. So with that, I will draw my inexpert story analysis to a close and move on to our food ingredient, which I feel doesn't actually require any guessing. You're right, it's salt. I've been avoiding doing this as it's so huge a topic, but because I've recently developed a talk on food and obligation where salt features what I'm going to go with heavily, I think I might be ready to face it now. Some of you, you know me well, so I think you'll also know that I won't be examining the whole history of salt as an ingredient and all the accompanying folklore. We definitely do not have time, and others, Mark Kalansky for one, have done it better and before me, so I'm just going to pick and choose the things I like and hope, gentle listener, that we share some similar tastes in such things. I'll start with a Kalansky quote though, so you can see what we're dealing with. Salt is so common, so easy to obtain, and so inexpensive that we have forgotten that from the beginning of civilization until about 100 years ago, salt was one of the most sought-after commodities in human history. It's big, isn't it? Why was it so important? Essentially, we all need salt for our survival. In the days of hunter-gatherers, that wouldn't have been such a problem, as we can get pretty much all we need if we just eat red meat regularly. However, when we settled down, started eating grain and vegetables and keeping animals rather than eating all of them, it suddenly became a huge problem because we had less salt available to us and animals need it as much, if not more, than we do for survival. Salt became very much in demand, especially as we didn't realise how much of it there was everywhere until we discovered modern geology. You could see why it was associated with wealth. If you had something everybody needed, you could set your own prices, and people did. There also had to be ways to get all that valuable salt from place to place, so trade routes were developed, some still known as salt roads. One of the other language clues about how important salt was is how it still features in our language. If you're lucky enough to be employed, usually in a non-manual position, you may well receive a salary, based on the Latin word salarium, which comes from sal, which means salt. The earliest use of salary in Middle English was in 1377. There's some controversy about the fact that Roman soldiers received their salary in salt, or was an allowance to buy salt. Some people believe this didn't happen, and that we have records of soldiers being paid certain amounts of currency, at first 3 times a year and then 4 times a year. But the thing is, ancient Rome covered a large period of time, and it may well be they could have, early in the civilization, been paid in salt, and then that developed into cash amounts, or maybe partly in salt. Because, you know, they were paid some of their income for salt, which was a valuable commodity, or it could have simply been a bonus. We may never know now, but either way, it demonstrates the link between money and salt, which remains to this day. It isn't just about the money, though. There is a sex connection. Have you ever considered the etymology of the word salacious? It comes from the word for lustful or libidinous man, salax, which actually comes from the Latin root word salire, to jump. However, there have been suggestions made that there's a double meaning, because salt was once considered to have, well, shall we say, an exciting effect on the nervous system, to the extent that Egyptian priests had to deprive themselves of salt before certain rituals. So the sal in salacious could also be from salt, as well as from leaping. Personally, I think it's a bit of a big reach, but you can see why it's appealing as a theory. There is one place where we see salt, or its Latin root word, regularly, and that is in a healthy, balanced diet. I know, surprising, isn't it? Increased salt consumption is something we're all supposed to be avoiding. I am being a little disingenuous here, because we see that root word as in salad. Yep, that poor, innocent depository of several of our 5 a day. The reason that salt is associated is because the Romans used to believe that greens should be salted to remove their bitterness. Sadly, so salad, literally, comes from the Latin for salted. They used to salt cabbages, etc., as well as dressing lettuces with salt in the form of garum. The simplest dressing was known as oxygarum, a mixture of vinegar and garum, sometimes enriched with spices, and it was used by even the poorest citizens. The ancient Romans preserved many vegetables in brine, sometimes with the addition of vinegar, including fennel, asparagus, and cabbage. They also preferred olives for consumption, as they needed a significant amount of help to become the delicious accompaniment to drinks, as well as the flavour bomb in many delicious dishes we know today. However, it should be added, it was actually the ancient Egyptians who discovered the process, partly because they had olives that were fairly rubbish for oil production and needed to find something to do with the inedible rejects. They didn't leave us with any recipes though, sadly, so you may need to use the ancient Roman one if you fancy trying a historical project. The ancient Egyptians were also credited with using salt to cure meat and fish, as they discovered that salt was so bulky to ship, it was better to sell a value-added product, which would be easier to transport and have higher profit margins. However, before you start thanking the Egyptians for your delicious ham, I feel I should break it to you. Egyptians refused to cook and eat pork. Your celebration ham is almost certainly a direct result of the Celts, who prized the legs of the boar and then domestic pigs and used salt to cure them and keep them fresh. This is all very well, but it isn't just in our kitchens that salt was important. Salt was extremely important across the rest of our lives, even if that influence was only symbolic. It even remains in a lot of British place names. Early medieval English language uses the suffix witch to delineate the presence of a salt works. So Northwich, Nantwich, Droitwich, Middlewich were all salt-producing towns. It can get a bit confusing, because some of the other towns that end in witch come from a different route and they didn't produce salt, so we'll just stick with those ones. I was struggling to find the best way to describe why salt's so important, but although I have some significant doubts about some of the content of his essay about the symbolic significance of salt in folklore and superstition, I think the psychoanalyst Ernest Jones may have summarised the importance of salt beautifully. He starts, "Salt is a pure, white, immaculate and incorruptible substance, apparently irreducible into any further constituent elements and indispensable to living beings. It has correspondingly been regarded as the essence of things in general, the quintessence of life and the very soul of the body. It has been invested with the highest general significance, far more than that of any other article of diet, was the equivalent of money and other forms of wealth, and its presence was indispensable for the undertaking of any enterprise, particularly any new one. In religion, it was one of the most sacred objects, and to it were required all manner of magical powers. the pungent, stimulating flavour of salt, which has found much metaphorical application in reference to pointed, telling wit or discourse, doubtless contributed to the conception of it as an essential element. To be without salt is to be insipid, to have something essential lacking. The durability of salt and its immunity against decay made it an emblem of immortality. It was believed to have an important influence in favouring fertility and fecundity, and in preventing barrenness. This idea is connected with other attributes than the one just mentioned, probably indeed with them all. The permanence of salt helped to create the idea that for one person to partake of the salt of another formed a bond of lasting friendship and loyalty between the two, and the substance played an important part in the rites of hospitality. A similar application of it was for confirming oaths, ratifying compacts, and sealing solemn covenants. This conception of a bond was also related to the capacity salt has for combining intimately with a second substance and imparting to this its peculiar properties, including the power to preserve against decay, for one important substance, namely water. It had, in fact, a natural and curious affinity. I know that's possibly the longest quote, but it felt important. Salt was so important to us that in alchemy it was considered to be one of the three ultimate elements out of which the seven noble metals were generated. Mercury symbolised the spirit, sulphur the soul, and salt the body. Mercury represented the act of illumination, sulphur that of union, and salt that of purification. The amount of salt in the blood was even used as an argument of male supremacy over women and was even promoted as late as the earliest 20th century, as demonstrated by an extract from the article Man as Salt of the Earth, Science versus Suffragists. While the suffragists are loudly acclaiming equality with man, if not superiority, it has been left to scientists to establish that man is literally the salt of the earth. Two famous French savants have just announced the result of a long series of investigations, which convinces them beyond all question of doubt that woman is unalterably man's inferior because of the smaller percentage of chloride of sodium in her blood. In other words, the blood of the male is more salt than that of the female, and observations of animal life show the more salt there is in the blood, the higher the intelligence and general development. The indictment does not end there, for these savants declare their combined physiological and psychological investigations have proved that woman is inferior to man in everything: intelligence, reason, and physical force. Now, I've got some thoughts, and some very rude words to say about this, but to save having a quick adult content warning on the podcast, I'm going to keep them to myself and let you imagine them instead. We fought wars over salt, and the Chinese, the Romans, the French, the Venetians, the Habsburg even taxed it to raise money for other wars. I bet you thought I'd forgotten about salt in hospitality and folklore, hadn't you? I haven't. I'm ignoring it in hospitality, as I've covered that to an extent in a recent talk I did for the Edgeways Collective, and if I start again here about it, we'll never be finished. I do, however, wish to explore it in folklore, as there's some fascinating examples. It was said to be particularly important on the Isle of Man. No person will go out to any material affair without taking some salt in their pockets, much less remove from one house to another, marry, put out a child, or take one to nurse without salt being mutually exchanged. Though a poor person be almost famished in the streets, he will not accept any food you give him unless you join salt to the rest of your benevolence. In both England and France, it was considered unlucky to be helped to salt at the table. Salt was passed and placed in front of the person, who then added salt themselves. It's apparently the reason for the phrase, "help me to salt, help me to sorrow." Spilling salt at the table was also considered incredibly unlucky, to the extent of throwing spilled salt into the fire over the left shoulder to try and hit the devil in the eye as he appeared, or even for the spiller to resort to crawling under the table, coming out the opposite side to avoid the bad luck coming their way. In the north of England, it was considered dangerous to give salt to someone, as it put the giver into the power of the recipient. The power could be in the format of control over actions or acquiring their knowledge. The idea of salt controlling a person's will is also the focus of this spell from the south of England, which was used to effect the return of a neglectful lover by throwing salt into the fire on three successive Friday nights. Their newly enamoured lover was expected to return on the third Friday. The devil, and by association witches in the medieval period, were considered salt-averse, and they apparently didn't use any in their food. It was used as a way of identifying a witch or person of evil intent. Salt was also used to protect fields and livestock from the influence of witchcraft, and was noticeable in the dairy to protect milk and butter from turning. It was used to prevent the souls of the dead from returning to each and ensure their to earth and ensuring their presence in purgatory. It was used to protect babies from evil influences both before and after baptism. Babies were either washed in salt water, or even in France, were surrounded by salt to protect them from the evil eye, or the fair folk, who were known for stealing children. In other European countries, babies were given a tiny amount of salt, or a small bag of protective salt was placed in their cradle. In Scotland, it was even customary to put salt into a child's mouth on entering a stranger's house for the first time. The salt for a newborn rule also applied to baby calves. Salt was carried to new homes to protect the threshold. It wasn't just for protection, though. It was used to burst fertility, starting with the wedding itself. In the Pyrenees, the wedding couple put salt in their left pocket before clearing it for church to guard against impotence. In other areas of France, this was also done, but sometimes by the groom alone and sometimes the bride. Sometimes it was placed in the shoe of the bride instead of the pocket, or just generally in clothes, which must have been very uncomfortable. In Scotland, it was strewn around the new home of the couple to avoid the evil eye during their wedding night, as well as promote a fertile marriage. If measures taken during the wedding to ensure fertility didn't succeed, there's an Indian ceremony which involves salt, which is entered into by a woman who's yet to be with child. She first fasts on the fourth lunar day of every dark fortnight and breaks her fast only after seeing the moon. A dish of 21 balls of rice, one of which contains salt, is then placed before her. And if she first lays her hand on the ball containing the salt, she'll be blessed with a son. In this case, no more is eaten. Otherwise, she goes on until she takes the salted ball. The ceremony may only be observed a limited number of times. If in these she fails altogether to pick out the salted ball first, she's doomed to barrenness. It wasn't just humans, though, that were made more fecund and fertile by the application of salt. Pregnant mares and cows in Belgium used to have salt mixed with their food to improve the chance of an easy birth. In Normandy, it was given to cows to increase their butter output. In Scotland, they used to add salt to the first milk after calving to increase milk production. In parts of the country now known as the Czech Republic, a special cake was made with salt, was given to pregnant cows to ensure a prime calf and excellent future milk production. Salt is also used in some modern magic rituals and spells in various traditions. I'm not a practitioner, but I believe amongst other myriad uses, white salt is sometimes used to create a pure space of practice. Salt can also be used in rituals to discourage unwelcome visitors from returning and to encourage bad neighbours to move away. You know, I said there wasn't a recipe. Well, there sort of is a recipe. I'm not going to read them out here. I will pop them on the blog post, though. They're from a book that was printed in 1978. And the recipes, well, let's just say they're not for eating. But if, you know, you have people that you don't want to come to stay, they might be effective. I think that's all I've got time for. And I haven't even begun to explore all the folklore around salt. I just haven't started. However, I would like to leave you with my favourite salt creation myth. From the mythical lore of Finland, we learn the Ilmarinen, the great Finnish hero, built a mill in his magical forge which could grind out wheat, gold and salt. The mill was stolen by a very powerful witch. When Ilmarinen was trying to rescue the mill known as the Sampo, it was unfortunately dropped into the sea. It broke, but the largest pieces became the great wealth and riches of the ocean. The portion with ground salt sits on the seafloor until this very day, grinding out salt, and that is why the sea is salty. And the smaller pieces, formed of the brightly coloured lid, were cast ashore all throughout the lands of Finland, and where they fell, the land was fertile and rich ever after. And that, I'm afraid, is all we've got time for today. I just also wanted to remind you, if you don't subscribe, why don't you subscribe? Okay, if you don't subscribe, and no one has to subscribe, you might miss out this month on 4 amazing bonus episodes that I have created from conversations I've had with amazing food writers. There's a link in the show notes that links to the page with all of these conversations on, so that you can link to them and listen to them. They'll be coming out on a Tuesday every week now until the end of September. The first one is with an amazing food writer and psychiatrist called Aaron Valance, and I think you will absolutely love it. So please head on over. If you subscribe, you know, well done, and that's wonderful. It really is, because it means you don't have to. It'll be there in your inbox. Well, I guess podcast inbox, but your podcast listening queue anyway. And hopefully you'll get to hear it after this. You won't even have to lift a finger. As well as that, in the show notes, there is the links to my website where you find the recipe. I mean, which isn't exactly a recipe this week, but you know, it's where the rest of the recipes are. It's also where you'll find the link to my Substack newsletter, which I love and I hope you would. You can actually have that delivered to you every week. I want to say wrapped in ribbon, but I think we all know it doesn't come wrapped in ribbon because it comes virtually. Virtual ribbon? Anyway, it comes to you every week and it's full of the things that I don't get to put in the podcast because there isn't space or there isn't time or they're slightly irrelevant to the topic at hand. But if you're interested in a lot of the things that are on the podcast, you might enjoy it too. Alternatively, you can come and hang out with me on social media. I am Fairytales at Fairytalesfood on Twitter, and I am at Fairytalesfood on Instagram. I have to admit, I'm not around on Instagram very often, but I'm definitely there on Twitter, and I'll happily have a chat. Oh, and I'm supposed to say, please would you leave a review if you love this? or even if you just like it and prepared to say it's 5 stars, frankly, but please leave a review. It does mean it's easier to other people to find us. But that's it, I think. So thank you for listening to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.